From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, a gunslinger from the Old West. You've heard about Wild Bill Hickok, seen the photos, long curly hair, bushy mustache. They say he killed a lot of men. The writer Tom Clavin says he really was as quick as lightning when he drew his gun, and the real stories are maybe better than the made-up ones. Clavin will join us to talk about his new biography, Wild Bill, in just a moment.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Out of a lot of great legendary figures of the Old West, the writer Tom Clavin says Wild Bill Hickok may have been the biggest. Before he turned 30 years old, Hickok had a gunfight, a duel, in the dusty streets of Springfield, Missouri. The scene was like in the movies, where he had two men facing off in the center of town, innocent bystanders scattering. Clavin says it was the first recorded quick-draw gunfight on the American frontier. And Hickok was fast. Fast as lightning, they said. And when he shot the man right through the heart, it made him a folk hero. Today in the program, Tom Clavin is joining us to talk about his new book. It's called Wild Bill. Clavin is a journalist and a writer. He reported for the New York Times for some 15 years. He's written a number of books, including Dodge City. He's going to be coming to Utah this week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He joined us to tell some of the stories of Wild Bill, who was gunned down in a saloon when he was just 39. But as Clavin told us, he managed to live a pretty full life.
We almost call it the true story of the lives of America's first gunfighter, because Wild Bill, he was 39 when he was killed, and in that those 39 years, he really lived the life of several people. Early in his life, he was a farmer. He was a gunfighter. He was a spy for the Union Army. He was a plainsman. He was a buffalo hunter. He was a scout for the U.S. Army. He was a gambler. He was an actor who even appeared on the stage in New York. So it is kind of amazing that how many lives Wild Bill Hickok lived in only 39 years.
Why do you figure, Tom Clavin, that it really has been, if I get this right, since the 1960s that someone has attempted a real deep dive biography of Wild Bill?
I think some writers may have had the initial hesitation I did, which is, well, there must be a lot of material out there about Wild Bill Hickok. Mm-hmm. And so they've sort of steered clear of it. You know, you could have somebody who's so famous that the assumption is that life has been covered extensively. And it's true with somebody like Abraham Lincoln. I think at last count there's something like 1.2 million mm-hmm. books about mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln. But in the case of Wild Bill Hickok, when I first thought about it and discussed it with my editor as sort of like a follow-up to my book Dodge City, I said, well, I'll look. It's probably not going to be a project that's going to be worth doing. And then I did discover that the last full-length biography for a mainstream audience was done by Joseph Rosa in 1964, and he did a slightly updated paperback version 10 years later. So you're talking now about 45 years later is when my book Wild Bill comes out. And in that time, there's been some more scholarship done. There's been more information gathered. I think there's a renewed appreciation for some of these American frontier figures that we want to know more about their stories and by extension our history. So I found myself feeling very fortunate that you have somebody, the combination of somebody who is an iconic figure, a readily recognizable name, but at the same time there's so much that's not known about that person.
When you started approaching these stories, how did you think about sifting through the legend part and the truth part? I suppose you have to come at this with a lot of skepticism initially.
Well, you do, because there's a lot that has been written about Wild Bill, maybe not so much in the last 40 years, as I said, but in In the case of Wild Bill, there's a lot of material out there, but a lot of it is not true. Some of it was just outright fictions. He's credited with killing hundreds of men as if he just mowed them down in whatever streets he was in. There's the whole romance supposedly between him and Calamity Jane turns out to be a falsehood. And there's so many other things that are either, if not made up completely, they're embellished, they're exaggerated. So the idea was to go through pretty much everything, you know, sift through everything, and you start to see things that can be corroborated, especially if you compare them to some of the original reporting about Wild Bill that was done back in the 1860s and especially the 1870s when there were more newspapers available. And you start to get a picture of somebody that's based more on fact than on fictions. And, you know, I was very fortunate in that when that picture started to emerge, that picture to me was more interesting than the fictions. I mean, if you can have a fascinating life and you can tell it factually, well, how much better is that than just making up some kind of cartoon?
Wild Bill became famous really young in his life, but you say in some ways that was something of a curse for him. In fact, it seems like you see his life as kind of a tragedy on some level.
I do, and that's why early in the book I found it very ironic or maybe just coincidental that the generations before, his family, the Hickox family in England, had farmed on Shakespeare's land in Avon, England, because I did see Wild Bill Hickok as kind of a Shakespearean tragic hero. He found fame early. It was a lot of fame. I mean, he was our big post-Civil War first celebrity of the American frontier. There were others that would come after him, soon after him. In the case of Buffalo Bill, Bat Masterson, Wyatt Earp, and of course some of the outlaws, but he was quite a celebrity, and then that was a curse because it made him kind of a marked man. It's become kind of a cliche over the decades in the film business that you make a movie about a gunfighter who wants to leave being a gunfighter and have a normal life. I mean, Shane comes immediately to mind, and there's even a movie called The Gunfighter with Gregory Peck with just that plot. And he couldn't necessarily. And then at a time when it seemed like he had a chance, you know, he had found the love of his life. He had gotten married. He was going to try and live a life that was not on the edge of the frontier. The cowardly Jack McCall appeared and murdered him.
Yeah. Well, let's back up and talk about his beginnings. I guess first we should point out he wasn't really named Bill.
No. He was James Butler Hickok was his name. And throughout his life, thankfully, he was a letter writer so that there were, you know, actual letters to refer to that have his voice in them. And some of them are quoted in the book. But he always referred to himself as James, Jim. He would sometimes sign things J.B. Hickok. It's kind of a strange story. But his brother, Lorenzo, was the one called Bill in the family. And strangely, that's because when the family had a baby named Lorenzo, the baby died in his infancy, and so they had another son and named the next one Lorenzo.
Yeah.
So as not to confuse him and his dead brother, they called him Bill. Somehow, on the frontier, that Bill got transferred to James Butler Hickok, who became known as Bill Hickok, and eventually there was an incident where he was helping a bartender who was being besieged by a bunch of bullies, and somebody thought that was a pretty wild thing to do, and he got the nickname Wild Bill Hickok.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine that. There's some woman in the street who said, "Good for you, Wild Bill," and she gives him this name that we all know him by now.
Yeah, and you have to speculate a little bit because he wasn't, from what I understand and the information that's available, he wasn't called Wild Bill because he was acting in a wild fashion. It was just kind of a wild act that he was strolling down the street, basically. And it was at the early in the Civil War, and a bartender who had Southern sympathies was serving drinks to several men who were Union supporters, and the bartender was not discreet enough. He voiced some of his sympathies for the Southern cause, and so the guys who were drinking just ganged up on him, were beating him up, and Hickok came along and he saw this going on, and he himself was a very Union supporter. He'd grown up in an abolitionist family. He was very anti-slavery. But his sense of fair play was you don't have four or five guys jumping this one poor guy.
Yeah.
So he got into the fray on the side of the bartender and It was later that evening. He was walking by some kind of gathering, and a word had spread about what this kind of wild act, you know, that this guy had done, of inserting himself into an unfair fight. And so that's when the woman cried out, "Good for you, Wild Bill," and that name stuck.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned his family's anti-slavery sentiments. Now, they were New Englanders. He was raised in Illinois, but the context of his family from New England is important because they were very much abolitionists. And this this is something that I think was very important to this family.
It was important, so important that when they were on their farm in Illinois, his family had all come, you know, when they immigrated from England, had settled in New England, and generations of Hickoks were in New England. His father was the one to lead that area and start a farm in Illinois. And his father was such an abolitionist that he actually used his farm as a station on the Underground Railroad. And, you know, there's stories in the book about when James Butler Hickok was a young man, Jim, sometimes he and one of his brothers would be sort of like providing cover. His father would hide some runaway slaves in his wagon, and he would take two of his sons on the wagon with him so that when anybody looked, it just looked like a farmer and his couple of sons were, you know, driving to the market or driving away from the market or wherever they were going. And they would be sometimes, you know, hopefully would be not accosted by any law people around or bounty hunters, slave hunters. But every so often they got discovered and there would be a wild chase and gunshots and everything. And this was Jim Hickok's childhood.
Yeah. It's interesting. His father dies when he's fairly young. And so you say the job of providing food fell to James, to Wild Bill. And at this point, he's pretty comfortable with guns, which, of course, is a theme in his life. He was an excellent marksman, you talk about. What do we know about how he got to be so good?
Well, he was able to buy a gun, an old gun. He did some chores for other nearby farmers and earned some money and bought a gun. And for him, it was a way to help the family out. He would just go off into the forest and into the fields, and he would shoot game and bring him back, and that would help the family to eat. Because his father not only died young, but he was not in good health for much of his life, so he wasn't the best provider. So if young Jim Hickok could go out and bring back some turkey or rabbit or whatever he shot, that's great. That gave the family something to eat. And that became even more of a responsibility when his father passed away. I mean, Jim was one of, I think, four brothers. So it wasn't like he was the only one to support the family, but it was important that he do what he could. And he became at an early age comfortable with guns. And the rest of his family were strictly farmers. You know, they were not people who found guns that interesting other than, you know, basic protection or basic, you know, local hunting. And that was something that distinguished Wild Bill, because he became also good with handguns and good with a gun in either hand. I mean, his accuracy was pretty much exactly the same whether he shot with his right – he was a righty – whether he shot with his right or his left hand. Yeah. And that was one of the things that distinguished him when he was on the frontier.
And it's interesting. You talk about how as you say, his family, they weren't really into guns. They were farm folk, and it seems like – there is a chance that he could have been pretty content doing that. But then the family has to get rid of the farm, move into town, and that seems to have changed him in some way.
Yeah. You know, there's a good chance that he would have, you know, set off on his own anyway because he seemed to have a restless spirit, which was the case for the remainder of his life.
Yeah.
But moving into town was something – he was not a town person, certainly at that point in his life. And so he wanted to leave, and his family talked him out of it and said, listen, at least stay until you're 18. You know, help us here with our new surroundings, which he did. And then he and a brother, happened to be his brother Lorenzo, they took off for Kansas, the idea being that they were going to find a new homestead for the Hickok family. They were going to leave Illinois. They were going to go out to the frontier where so many other people were going because the land was cheap and plentiful. And that got him away from the Illinois Hickok homestead. And as it turned out, the rest of his family that he left there, and Lorenzo eventually returned, they were quite content to live there for the rest of their lives. In fact, if you go to to the cemetery there in what's now Homer, Illinois, there's the graves of his parents, of his siblings, because they all were content to stay there the rest of their lives. I mean, in 1916, three of the siblings died within a few months of each other. There was a very tight family, but Jim was the one who wanted to wander, and he did. And that's how wandering was really what he did the rest of his life.
So he conceives of a life of adventure for himself at some point fairly early. I mean, you talk about how he read about Daniel Boone and Kit Carson, and he imagines himself doing what? Going west, I guess.
Going west, maybe having some adventures. I mean, he was, I think, sincere when he said he would find a homestead and maybe start a farm and then have the rest of his family come out. But it was partly his restlessness and partly the events that he found himself in. I mean, Illinois was generally a pretty quiet state at that time, but that was not the case about Kansas. Kansas in the 1850s was earning the nickname Bloody Kansas because of the constant tension there between was it going to enter the Union as a slave state or as a free state. And it wasn't just people on the street having arguments about it. They were actually forming armies and fighting each other and having these battles, these citizen armies, and egged on by John Brown and his faction, to whether, you know, they were the pro-slavery people would invade from Missouri, and you'd have the anti-slavery people have their own army and they would fight the pro-slavery people. And it was a terrible time, even politically. As I write in the book, there was during the 1850s, Kansas had like six governors.
Yeah,
there was even two governors holding the title at the same time for 3 days, and it was just utter chaos. And that's the environment that the young Jim Hickok found himself in, and he got caught up in it. And when the Civil War started, he enlisted in the Union Army because he believed in the cause of ending slavery. Maybe not expecting his life in the Union Army would be more adventurous than he anticipated,
yeah.
But he ended up being a spy, and that you can't get more adventurous than
no,
that.
No, you can't. Lots of great stories there. It's interesting. He meets Buffalo Bill, Bill Cody, early in life. This was a surprise for me. I didn't realize that they connected throughout their lives.
Again, it's one of the fun things that most people would not know about ordinarily, even though both names are very immediately recognizable, to find out that they became very good friends. And the way they met each other, there's about a 10-year age difference. And Buffalo Bill Cody, who was only Billy Cody at the time, was 11 years old and helping out on a wagon train. And some bully started to beat him up. And again, Hickok, who was always on the side of fair play and giving a guy a chance, he told the bully, he said, you know, don't you do that or you won't be able to sit down for a month of Sundays. And the guy backed down. You know, Hickok was an imposing guy, and he knew how to fight. He knew how to use his fists. He didn't need guns to win a fight, but he could do both. He could win a fight with his fists, or he could win a fight with his guns. And people early on, he exuded that kind of confidence and that kind of danger. And a lot of fights that he could have had did not happen because people simply backed down.
Well, that leads us to his look. Let's talk a little bit about that because it's very distinctive. He was tall. He was really lean, self-confident. You talk about there's this photo that he gets taken in, I think it was 1858 or so when he was pretty young. He's got this kind of thin mustache and long brown hair is a thing too. And then later he takes on an even more distinctive look. It's like he had this sense of style, like he was trying to make a statement almost.
Well, I think he was. He, you know, he was not somebody who boasted about himself. He was not an immodest person, but he knew he had a distinctive look. He knew he was a handsome man. I mean, he had girlfriends along the way. I love the passage in the book by Libby Custer, who at the time was, I mean, she was George Custer's wife until Custer died, but at this particular time, she's 24 years old. It's the year after the Civil War ends, and she and her husband have been posted to this fort out on the prairie. And entering the fort is Wild Bill Hickok, who's going to scout for Colonel Custer. And she records her impression of him, and you could feel her gasping, you know, in awe. She's breathless, and it's like a real Bodice ripping passage there where she is just so immediately infatuated with Wild Bill. And I'm not saying he had that effect on every woman he encountered, but that was not, you know, an unusual effect. And here you had a woman who was, you know, supposedly happily married. I mean, sure, she had a handsome and dashing husband herself.
Yeah.
It wasn't like she was lacking some excitement in her life. But she meets Wild Bill Hickok, and she is just floored.
The buckskin leggings, the red shirt, or the kind of loud shirts sometimes, that broad-brimmed hat. And,
sombrero,
of course, those two pistols. Was he cultivating a look? I mean, if he were walking down the dusty street somewhere, I guess you would have noticed him, of course.
Yes. And I think, you know, it's one of the things I talk about in the book is that kind of contradiction, because he wanted to be noticed. He wanted to he presented well. He bathed every day. We might take that for granted and say, well, of course he bathed every day. No, people were not bathing every day on the frontier, sometimes not for weeks. But he made sure whether it was going to be in a town bathhouse or it was going to be jumping in a stream, wherever he had to. And then he would be, he would have put the outfit on with the sombrero, with the yellow moccasins. And sometimes when he was in town gambling, he'd wear a Prince Albert coat. And so on the one hand, he wanted to be noticed. He knew he presented well, that he was a distinguished figure. On the other hand, especially as the years went on and he acquired a larger and larger reputation as a gunfighter, as what they called at the time a man killer, it made him more of a target, you would think, because there was no way that Wild Bill Hickok was going to blend in.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of dangerous, but he was defiant about it. This is me. This is who I am, and long hair and everything. And when he rode into town, people would nudge each other and said, there's Wild Bill. There was like no mistaking who just rode into town.
Yeah.
So it made him a target, but he wasn't going to change for that.
I want to ask you about his pistols. He carried I guess he carried various at times. I mean, he carried double-action Colt 44s, and he filed down the catches for a kind of quickness. What was his relationship with his pistols?
Well, he really enjoyed firing guns. I don't mean that he fired indiscriminately and that he fired them at people or taunted them or anything like that. There was some of that later on when he was a stage actor in New York, but he enjoyed firing guns. He enjoyed putting on shooting exhibitions. Sometimes he'd be a little bored maybe with something else, or he needed to get over a bad night at the gaming tables. And he'd have people gather around, and they would be setting up these challenges for him. You know, he could throw coins in the air, throw this in the air, shoot this down, and you know, there'd be all kinds of challenges that would be set up for him. And he would enjoy performing these they're not tricks, but these feats of accuracy with either hand. He'd show how fast he was with drawing his guns, how fast he was at firing, how accurate he was at firing. And people got a big kick out of it, and he got a kick out of it. He liked to entertain people. He had no idea at the time he was setting himself up for a phase of his life in the theater. But and he turned out when he was actually in the theater, he didn't really like performing that much. But when it was sort of like an ad hoc, a fun thing with some local people in whatever town he was in, it was fun. And his guns were an extension of basically of his arms, of his hands.
Yeah.
He was very comfortable with guns, and that reputation probably saved his life more than once, because there were fewer people that wanted to try and get the drop on him. They were afraid of him. He was a very intimidating figure.
Yeah. He becomes he does all kinds of different things in his life. You mentioned he becomes a teamster for a time, and he does encounter his boyhood hero, Kit Carson, for a bit. Had a night on the town with him.
They did. Carson was quite a bit older, and but Wild Bill had to go to New Mexico and Santa Fe as part of a wagon train he was on, and he encountered Kit Carson, who lived there, and Carson took him out on the town, and it was kind of fun. You know, most of us don't get to meet our boyhood idols, you know, or we find them lacking when we do. You know, my boyhood idol was Mickey Mantle. I never actually met Mantle, but of course in more recent years there have been stories about how he could be a rather unsavory character, unfortunately. But Hickok found Carson to be totally delightful, and they had a good time together. And as far as I know, it's the only time they ever got together. Carson died only a couple of 2-3 years after the Civil War. But that was a fun night in the town, and Hickok had that kind of satisfaction of meeting one of his heroes and thinking, oh, you know, he's just like I pictured.
There's a story you tell about he gets in a pretty bad scrape with a grizzly bear in 1860.
Mm.
How much of that do you think is true?
You know, I sort of put it that way in the book because I don't want to mislead readers and say, well, here's what I know for sure happened, because we don't know for sure. You know, he would describe that he encountered a grizzly bear and they got into a terrible fight and that wounded him severely. But there was nobody else other than the bear to vouch for this story,
right.
Other than there were a couple of accounts that it was not long after the supposed, you know, battle with the bear that he was hired to work at a stagecoach station. And the reason why the company put him there is he was still recovering from very serious injuries. Now, he could have fallen off a wagon. Who knows what the other – but the injuries that were described in a couple of these accounts were consistent with his story about encountering a bear that almost killed him. So, you know, I don't think there's anybody that even at the time that could have said, you know, this definitely happened. There were no witnesses. There, there was just Wild Bill. But it was at a time in his life when he was not prone to exaggerations and embellishments. I mean, later on, he came to sort of accept what was being said and written about him and sort of like went with it. But this was before then. So I tend to think it happened, but realizing that there can be no 100% confirmation.
I wanted to ask you about the time that he first kills a man. He'd become a stock tender, and he confronts a man named David McCandless at a place called Rock Creek Station. Talk about this first incident where he kills a man. I don't suppose we know much about what he thought about killing a man at first, do we?
Yeah. Well, I think he thought this was going to be possible when the time came because it was in 1861. He was at this Rock Creek station and he knew that this man, McCandless, had been giving the manager of the station a really hard time. And it was getting increasingly confrontational. And I think Hickok realized that either this guy is going to have to be, you know, persuaded to drop this thing, this dispute that they're having, or there's going to be some gunplay, some violence. So I think Hickok expected that that could happen. And so when this guy came over and was accosting the man and his family and entered the man's house and he had brought with him a couple of men with weapons, the shooting began and this guy and his two associates were killed. And Hickok is supposedly responsible for at least two of those deaths. And I think that he had to expect this was going to happen. And he went on trial, was tried for it. He was acquitted because this man McCandless had come to the family's home and accosted them on their property. But then soon afterwards when the Civil War began, and as we don't know, but he certainly would have killed men during the Civil War. So by the time the war ended, I'm not going to say he was comfortable with killing, but he knew what it was like. And sometimes he felt that you have no other choice. He didn't seek out confrontations, but there were times when he had no other choice.
What was it like if someone shot someone? I mean, what kind of justice would there be in these frontier kinds of towns? How did that play out?
Well, it was definitely evolving. The whole judicial system west of the Missouri River was being figured out almost like on a day-by-day basis. But self-defense was, you're automatically acquitted and it didn't have to be, you know, massive evidence of self-defense. So a lot of times people were acquitted and for sometimes even flimsy self-defense reasons. Judges were few and far between and they didn't necessarily get paid much or were men of great experience. So you couldn't really trust judges that much. You had lawmen at the time. Marshals and sheriffs and U.S. Deputy marshals roaming the territories. They, too, were, again, they didn't get paid much. There were no police academies at the time. Some men did have a good sense of right and wrong. Hickok was one of them. Later, you see, I think the same thing about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson in Dodge City and some of the other lawmen on the frontier. But, a lot of times people ended up taking the law in their own hands because the established law, what they hoped was established law, was either corrupt or was just simply not available. You know, you might have to ride dozens and dozens of miles to find a deputy sheriff or a deputy marshal. So Wild Bill, especially when he was in Abilene, for example, where he was marshal, he was the law. I'm not saying there was not a judge that ever came there or that there were not some kind of rudimentary judicial system, but for the most part, Wild Bill Hickok was the law, and if he did it effectively and fairly, then the law worked. If you have a lawman that's kind of corrupt or inept, then it doesn't work.
You mentioned he enlists in the war as a Union soldier. He's the only member of the Hickok family to actually enlist. And you mentioned
yes.
There were a lot of gaps in those Civil War years, but he does, as you mentioned before, becomes a spy for the Union Army. This sounds fascinating. A lot of good stories here of him, some fairly close calls and some escapes. Mm-hmm. But you say he didn't panic under pressure. And he often had to dress up like a Confederate officer, sometimes going behind enemy lines.
He did. And, of course, if you get caught and discovered to be a Union spy and you're wearing Confederate clothes, it's automatic, execution. There's not much wiggle room there. And there's even a story in there about when he was discovered and is put into this shack overnight that he's going to be killed in the morning and manages to escape. And that's kind of the fun part, because while Bill Hickok and his adventures in the Civil War could probably make a book by itself if we knew more.
Right.
The problem is we don't know. I mean, he was not writing letters about his behind-the-lines activities. And he was undercover for much of that time, and he was infiltrating Confederate ranks. And he would get information out to, you know, the Union side, and then have to go back, you know, embedded back with the Confederates. So I like that there was a story from Buffalo Bill's point of view when he was a soldier himself in the Union Army. And they come to this little cabin, and who does he find inside but his old friend Wild Bill Hickok, wearing a Confederate uniform and having, you know, sell a snack.
Yeah.
And so we had that perspective of, you know, this is not just Wild Bill saying he wore a Confederate uniform. We have Billy Cody walking into this cabin, and he recognizes his friend and that he's wearing a Confederate uniform. So that whole Civil War period is really interesting part of his life. But unfortunately, you know, we only have a certain amount of information to go by, and I certainly don't want to do this what some previous writers have done is embellish or exaggerate things that just aren't true.
Yeah. I like the section where you write about his time in Kansas and these cattle towns. You write about how across Kansas, where the railroad basically meets the cattle drives, and those cattle drives mm-hmm. sound amazing. But then there were these boom towns that sort of organically develop. And I guess it was around this time that Wild Bill was just sort of going from these boom towns to boom towns. I don't know if he seemed shiftless, but he liked to gamble. He seemed to just be kind of a drifter at the time.
Well, he certainly did not have a well-defined career path. Let's put it that way. He was not somebody who said, oh, here's what I'm going to do with my life, and he's going to pursue it. He was restless. He liked to wander. He would just go and see what the opportunities were. In some cases, he would be hired as a scout for the army, to a regiment. I think it's an interesting part of the book that he scouted for the 10th U.S. Regiment, which was made up all of black soldiers, the Buffalo soldiers. Now, they were not white scouts lining up to you know, live and work and scout for that black regiment. But Hickok was fine. He was an anti-slavery guy. He had grown up with black people hidden in the basement of his house. So I think that's interesting he did that. Or he might get hired to be a plainsman for a company, to be a stagecoach driver, to be a teamster. Or he might just hang around and be gambling for a while. And if he was on a good streak, why leave? I'll stay as long as the whiskey and the winnings are good. So it seemed like he was fine with wandering and just seeing what was around the next bend. And that was a good part of his life after the Civil War until basically – he became a marshal in Hays City, and then his most famous experience as a lawman was in Abilene. And then that was sort of like a whole different occupation, which is to be – you have to take sides. And what side of the law are you going to be on? He wanted to be on the side of law and order.
Tom Clavin, his new book is called Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. He's going to be in Utah this weekend, a guest of Utah Humanities and the bookstore The Printed Garden. He's giving a reading on Saturday afternoon at the Marmalade branch of the Salt Lake City Library. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Tom Clavin. We're talking about his book, Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. Clavin is coming to Utah this weekend. We'll give you more details about that a little later on the program. I want to ask you about the story that really makes him this public figure gives him this fame. It's in the summer of 1865, and it's a gunfight between Wild Bill and a man named Davis Tutt. Let's talk a little bit about what happened. This plays out in Springfield, Missouri. This was just after the end of the Civil War. They were kind of friends, or at least friendly. They played card games together. Tutt fought for the Confederacy. Hickok, as you say, was in the Union Army. And they end up in Springfield, both of them, I guess, going from card game to card game. And talk a little bit about what happened.
Well, Davis Tutt was, I think, one of the few people, perhaps the last person, to underestimate Wild Bill Hickok and underestimate the danger he was in by crossing Wild Bill Hickok. Davis Tutt, there's also the possibility that they were rivals for the affections of the same woman.
Right.
But they had a falling out, and Tutt was actually underwriting the efforts of other gamblers to play cards with Wild Bill and wipe him out. Because he thought, that would be my revenge. I'll get him wiped out. I'll make sure he's broke, and then he has to leave town. But Wild Bill was winning as much as he was losing. And one day, in a ill-advised fit of irritation, Tutt took Wild Bill's gold watch off the table and walked out with it.
Yeah.
And there were several attempts to get the watch returned, and Wild Bill did not want to fight him. And finally, Tutt was parading around the town square with it, and it was like, did he not realize that he was taunting Wild Bill Hickok into a position that he had to act, he had to get that watch back, or who knows what he was thinking? But the day came when they were on the town square and they were each armed, and it's the first recorded fast draw gunfight in that up until that point when two men confronted each other, it was more like a duel from the Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr kind of school of fighting, where you march off a certain amount of paces, you each take a shot. If you don't hit each other, you just say, okay, good, we got that done. Let's go have a drink. In this case, they both drew on each other, and Hickok drew very deliberately and shot Tutt and killed him with one shot. And how not only that Hickok had killed the man in broad daylight in the town square, but how cool he was and how calculated and how accurate he was, that spread around. This was somebody new. This is gunfighter was not the term that was used necessarily at the time. It was a man killer or shootist. So, but the word spread. We've got this man killer, this shootist in Springfield, and he's steer clear of him. Be careful of Wild Bill Hickok.
Well, it's in the afternoon. You mentioned, as you say, this plays out in broad daylight. You talk about how townspeople basically rushing for cover. I mean, it sounds like an iconic Western. They confront each other in the town square, turn sideways. And I like the way you describe Hickok pulls. I mean, he was lightning fast. Mm-hmm. Tutt goes for his pistol. Hickok pulls first. But not only that, balances his pistol on his bent left arm.
Mm-hmm.
He's so collected, so calm at the moment that he's able to pull it quickly and aim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, later in life, Hickok was asked about his calmness when things are getting out of control or seeming to in a fight, in a gunfight. And he said, if you don't believe that the bullet's been made that can kill me, you have nothing to worry about. And that was the kind of self-confidence he had. He really believed the bullet with his name on it had not been manufactured. Nobody had it in their gun. So he was going to prevail in a gunfight. So he didn't have to just start blasting away because he was nervous or afraid or desperate. If there was a fight, he believed he was going to win it. And he had that belief right up until the day he died.
Yeah. Well, he stays in Springfield after this incident, and he's approached by a writer from Harper's New Monthly magazine. And the important part of this part of the story, of course, is that this is how we, I guess, come to know Hickok as a kind of folk hero.
They do know him as a folk hero, yeah. He already is sort of known on the frontier already because of the gunfight and because of his, his look, his charismatic look. But what puts him over the top is you have this reporter from Harper's New Monthly magazine that interviews him and then, shortly after publishes this piece that – and that was a popular magazine at the time and especially back east. So you have these thousands upon thousands of people back east reading about this handsome, charismatic man killer, can shoot a gun accurately with both hands, rides the plains, saves people from Indians and all these other, stories. And some of the stories were true. Some of the stories were half true and were embellished. But it was a sensation. I kind of compare it to if somebody were to be profiled now on a major internet site or for a major celebrity magazine or Access Hollywood or something like that. Suddenly Wild Bill Hickok was a rock star.
Right.
And people were fascinated by him. And so more so than any other plainsman, any other person operating on the frontier, he was the famous one. And he symbolized, he represented, the dozens, if not hundreds, of other men on the plains who were hunting buffalo and scouting for the U.S. Army and doing the things that he did. But he just became the most famous of them all.
Well, he becomes kind of a heroic figure. But the alternative to that is that he's now seen as a marked man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, there have been all kinds of movie plots, stories. Shane, again, is an example, Jack Schaefer's book, about the gunfighter who wants to retire. And Hickok was young. He was not looking to retire. But one of the things that they become weary of is being a target. Knowing that there's somebody younger and perhaps faster who's going to come along and say, I'm not going to spend years making a reputation. I'm going to make it right now by killing you. And he knew that that was becoming more and more of a possibility in his life, that some young, fast gunman is going to, topple him and take his place as a star of the frontier. But he wasn't going to let him change it. He continued his life the way it was. As he said, I never let anybody get the drop on me. He was always wary. I write about in the book when he would be, especially when he was a lawman, he'd not walk along the sidewalks. He'd walk in the middle of the street because he didn't want to take a chance of somebody going past a doorway or an alley that somebody's waiting there for a gun. And he had his two six shooters. He had his shotgun. He had a Bowie knife. He had a Derringer in one of his pockets. He was well armed and very vigilant. So if somebody was going to try and kill him, they'd have to go to a lot of trouble to do it.
You tell the story about when Hickok killed a man named Phil Coe. This is when he's a marshal. And during the skirmish, he accidentally shoots and kills a good friend, a deputy, Mike Williams, who was helping him. And you say at this moment, Wild Bill began to, change inside.
I think at that moment he understood the downside of being a gunfighter. He understood it up to a certain point about being a target, but he was a very self-confident person and he took precautions and he wasn't going to let somebody get the drop on him. But he killed this man who he liked, who was a friend of his. It was an accident. He just thought it was another guy coming out of the darkness from behind to shoot him. But he changed inside because I think he started to realize the limitations of being the gunfighter and the consequences of it, and that you are accompanied by death wherever you go. And it didn't change him in the sense that he, chose a different path. He said, "You know what? I'm going to get into the bank business. I'm going to send my resume to Wells Fargo."
Right.
That didn't happen. But I think he wanted to be even more cautious and be more careful about getting into confrontations. And he was. It wasn't like he did not have any further confrontations, but he always tried to avoid them whenever possible because I think that Mike Williams' death really, made him understand unintended consequences.
He loses his job as a marshal. You talk about
victim of his own success. He cleaned up the town too well.
Yeah,
they didn't need him anymore.
Exactly, he becomes obsolete. You say,
yeah, he does.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that Hickok you describe as sort of the prototype of progress on the American frontier, but also the first victim.
Yes,
talk a little bit about that. How is the West changing? How is the frontier changing? Do you think?
Well, it was more important that lawmen be seen and were called peace officers. Keeping the peace became more important than outdrawing and outshooting the bad guys. And as towns became more populated and you had more families moving in there and they were building schools and building churches, and you see this happen, and they followed the railroad, across Kansas with Abilene and Hays City and eventually Dodge City and some other places on the frontier. You don't want shootouts breaking out in the middle of the town square. We've seen that in movies, which is kind of amusing, where you'd have these people start shooting each other and bullets are flying everywhere. Well, people did not want that because, women and children and store clerks or whatever could be hit and killed.
Yeah.
So they started to actually change from what they were called being sheriff or marshal to police departments and peacekeepers. Years later in Tombstone, for example, when the marshal of Tombstone left town, supposedly on a leave of absence, but he never came back because he was too afraid of all the violence there. They appointed Virgil Earp, but they didn't appoint him marshal necessarily. He was the chief of police department. So that's how things were starting to change. You had departments. You had people who started getting trained in techniques of how to be a police officer. And so Hickok was totally unsuited for that. You know, he brought that about in that, you know, in Hays City and then in Abilene, he brought peace to the town and allowed it to thrive as a civilized community and a civilized growing community. But a civilized growing community did not need a guy with two guns out on patrol every night.
He becomes, as you put it, this is it, in fact, a chapter title, a reluctant thespian. And Buffalo Bill, Cody, gets him involved in this production of he gets on Broadway. It's called Scouts of the Prairie. And you say that Wild Bill felt like he was risking his integrity, and this is how you put it in the book, dying a bit with every performance. Because it was kind of terrible, this thing. But even though people flocked to it, it just seemed too much for a man who had done such interesting things.
Well, he realized he was contributing to making a parody of himself.
Yeah.
You know, the basic plot of the story as it was, Scouts of the Plains, was you'd have Buffalo Bill Cody and Wild Bill Hickok and a fellow named Texas Jack and a couple other characters wandering in and out and a couple of Indians along for the ride who'd show up from time to time. And basically they were recounting and to some extent reenacting some of their adventures in the past while being scouts on the plains. He did it at first because Buffalo Bill talked him into it and they were very good friends and the money was good. You know, he was suddenly being offered $100 a week, which was like four times what his salary was as a sheriff or a marshal, and you didn't have to risk taking a bullet for it. And it was an adventure. He'd never been in New York City before. Let's go find out what New York City is like, and it could be fun. And he did, and he was a celebrity in New York City. And there's Wild Bill Hickok, and the people would flood to the box office. Oh my goodness, Wild Bill Hickok is going to be in a play right here in New York. We've got to see it. And it was a huge success, and they were printing money, basically. But after a while, he realized that this is kind of a silly way to make a living, that I'm playing myself and I'm saying these stupid lines, and the people are laughing at them. And even the lines that aren't intended to be funny, people are laughing at. And he felt embarrassed. It was undignified. And he couldn't wait. He started to get more and more restless. I got to get back to the plains. I got to get back to being who I am, not playing somebody who not playing the Wild Bill Hickok people think I am. And he got very frustrated. And eventually, you know, one night he like shot the lights out of a spotlight and he said, that's it. I'm gone.
Yeah. I can't decide, Tom Clavin, if you think the last part of his life was sad. I mean, 1871 and 72, he basically doesn't have a real home. He's just wandering, you know, from town to town, making money gambling. He didn't really save much money when he was doing the Broadway show. He's sort of a target. He just seems kind of, I mean, he's tragically shot and killed, of course. And I'm just wondering what you think might have happened with him eventually.
Well, that was something I wrestled with all the time I was working on the book and knowing I would get to the point where he was going to be shot and killed, shot from behind and killed, and that he was a man whose that the time and the country had passed him by, even though he was still only in his 30s. Mm-hmm. He had become an anachronism. He had become, you know, a remnant of the past. And he wasn't – I don't think there was the ability to change in him. I don't think there's anything else he could have done with his life that would have, you know, made him feel more contemporary in the 1870s into the 1880s and 1890s, however long he lived. And the other issue is that he was going blind. And he – you know, there's some speculation about what the specific ailment was, but whatever it was, every year he was losing a little bit more of his eyesight. Now, for a gunfighter, of course, that's a fatal ailment to have. But even just as a man who was always much an individual who roamed free, who didn't owe anybody anything, to be in a situation where his eyesight was starting to go. So it's his death, when it came, was tragic and totally unexpected and unanticipated. But on the other hand, you almost wonder if it saved him from what would have been a very difficult rest of his life.
You hope to revive the real idea of a Wild Bill, Tom Clavin?
I hope what the book does is introduce Wild Bill as a real character, as a real person, and actually have more respect for him than we would for the cartoon Wild Bill. You know, I actually have comic books, Wild Bill comic books, that I found a lot, part of my research, and I was able to acquire some. And there, he was sort of like, for that time, our Marvel superhero. You know, We didn't have Marvel comics. We didn't have Spider-Man and Hulk and Thor in those days. But the dime store novels and some of the comic books that eventually came along, they made, you know, Wild Bill, Buffalo Bill, some of the others our superheroes. And Wild Bill was a hero in a lot of ways, but not a superhero. I want people to see what an adventurous, amazing life he had. But it was a real life by a real person. And so I hope when people get to the last page, they say, wow, I'm really glad I was riding along with Wild Bill for the last few hours, however long it takes you to read it.
Tom Clavin, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to seeing the people in Salt Lake City.
Tom Clavin, his book is Wild Bill, the true story of the American frontier's first gunfighter. He's giving a reading this weekend at the Marmalade branch of the Salt Lake City Public Library. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.